You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
This is Larry Connors, USA. Larry Connors, USA.
Another night of protests outside the federal courthouse in Portland as officers inside give a final warning. Federal agents open the courthouse doors, facing a barrage of bottles and fireworks. In recent days, federal agents have seized Molotov cocktails, bats, hockey sticks, slingshots, cans, and garden sprayers filled with bleach and urine.
July the 29th, 2020. That's a report from Fox News on the violence in Portland. Did you hear that last part? Bottles and spray cans filled with bleach, urine. That's being tossed at our federal agents protecting a federal courthouse in Portland. Last night was night 62 in Portland. Now comes this breaking story. We're going to wait to see how it plays out. But the Oregon Democrat Governor Kate Brown now saying federal agents will begin a phased withdrawal. Apparently, Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf confirmed that he and the governor did reach a joint plan to end the activity in Portland directed at federal properties and law enforcement officers. And the Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, says this includes the robust presence of Oregon State Police in downtown Portland. That's why federal agents were there to begin with. The city of Portland could not, would not, did not try to defend the federal courthouse. That's why the federal agents came in and surrounded inside the building and stepping out as needed to try to protect it. Now, we're told the state will take over that protection. Well, that's fine. If they'll do it, that was the whole point. Yet we still have violence in other cities. And they continue to the extent that those, even in blue states and cities, have had enough. Virginia, Democrat governor, the state mostly blue, Richmond, Virginia, a Democrat mayor. They've been having nights of violence. And now the Richmond Times-Dispatch wrote in a column, enough is enough. We've normalized too many behaviors that make Richmond and the United States a less safe and prosperous place to live. That statement could be read all across the nation right now. And by the way, I'm tired of using, and I will not use the word protesters. I'm done with it. They're not protesters if they're rioting, if they're throwing, starting arson, looting, attempting to hurt city, state, county, national authorities. They will be called protesters if they're exercising only the First Amendment right, and that is freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. Otherwise, every time you see some news report talking about the protesters are blamed for fire, they're not protesters. They're arsonists. Libs still want to ignore and will not accept, and in fact continue to not condemn all of this violence. That was evidenced by Jerry Nadler in the Judicial Committee hearing yesterday with A.G. Barr. We'll get into that. We have a guest today, Michael Gonzalez, with the Heritage Foundation. He's written articles in Wall Street Journal, Forbes, USA Today, National Review, appearing on all major networks. He has a new book out, Perfect Timing, The Plot to Change America. We'll get into that. And the issue of censorship, shutting down conservative voices. We have plenty of examples of that. And then in the midst of all of this, are we going to have school? Will school start? Is it going to be more harmful for kids to stay home from school? Well, the nation's largest teachers union is now starting a fear campaign. It says many of its members are so anxious about returning to school that these teachers are preparing with, quote, living wills and additional life insurance. According to the National Education Association, quote, anxious educators have a message for administrators and lawmakers We want to teach our students, but we don't want to die doing it. Well, of course not. But again, they're claiming that any direction for us to go back to schools is reckless, unreasonable, unnecessary. And they again are saying that, guess what we will do is prepare living wills and get more life insurance. Now, do you imagine that's going to also frighten kids and parents, maybe more than they should be? Precautions are good. Fear, mongering, not good. Does not help anything, anyone. As you can tell, we have a lot to cover over the next 2 hours. Let your friends and neighbors know we're on the air so they can listen in. Lock and load. Ready. On the right.
You can email Larry at LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com. LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com.
So are you ready to get out from the COVID-19 scare? We might still need to be careful in some areas. I do encourage businesses to make sure your facility is clear of COVID-19. And, of course, if you open up and then a client or an employee or someone else surfaces with COVID-19, you need to reevaluate what's going on. I would encourage you to contact Wellington Environmental. They can determine at a very reasonable cost what you need to do before you open. Once you are open, and as you move forward, it just makes good sense, doesn't it? Wellington Environmental, for 30 years, has been treating situations at hospitals, schools, daycare centers, private homes. 314-644-4930. 644-4930. Wellington Environmental. Be well with Wellington Environmental. I want to thank my friends at John Bill Roofing for sponsoring this segment of Larry Connors USA. John Bill Roofing, covering homes, businesses throughout the Midwest with the best quality and lowest price. John Bill Roofing. Call 1-800-NEW-ROOF. 1-800-NEW-ROOF.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
In most of these cities, the protests had begun to wind down before you marched in and confronted the protesters. You did it here in Washington. You did it at Lafayette Square. You expanded to Portland. And now you are projecting fear and violence nationwide in pursuit of obvious political objectives. Shame on you, Mr. Barr.
Shame on you, Mr. Barr. That is House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler, while yesterday chairing the hearing with Attorney General William Barr. They were so anxious to get Barr in front of this committee. Again, keep in mind, this is a House Judiciary Committee hearing, and the House is controlled by the Democrats, and they were looking to get Barr in there to show that he's been nothing more than a puppet for Trump. And everything he does is simply to follow the lead and directions of Trump, ignoring the law, simply carrying out orders from on high. And Jerry Nadler, of course, in the process, denying, basically, the riots have been underway. He said there's been no trouble until you sent the federal agents in. That's a flat-out lie. Federal agents, for instance, since he brought up Portland, were sent into Portland because of, quote, rioters, not protesters. Rioters continued to throw things at the courthouse, trying to tear off the scaffolding covering the windows so they could throw explosive and arson devices inside, even knowing that there were people inside the courthouse during the evenings. And I told you yesterday, in Atlanta, attacks on the ICE offices in Atlanta, they recovered some explosives that apparently were taken from some of the rioters, not protesters, that had nails packed into these commercial explosives, looking not just to start a fire and cause a big bang and explosion, but to maim and possibly kill. And yet you've got Jerry Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, telling Attorney General Barr everything was hokey-donkey, just perfect till you set the federal agents in. By the way, Nadler, of course, just recently called the violence by Antifa, quote, a myth. He said there's no violence. Antifa's not responsible for this. It's a myth. Well, you know what? Even Antifa would disagree with that. Hey, don't diss what we're doing. Yeah, we're not a myth. Yeah, we are responsible for that. That's what we want to claim. We want credit. So again, repeating what we had at the top of the monologue, news coming out now that there's an agreement reached between the Oregon Democrat Governor, Kate Brown, and Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, that they will begin the pulled back phase out of federal agents at the courthouse in Portland, with the understanding that the Oregon State Police will move into downtown Portland and they will take over protecting the federal building. So they're definitely believing, look, if the federal agents are here, all the violence will stop. How many cities have we seen the violence directed against normal police officers? Even police vehicles sitting on the street. No federal activity, just a police car sitting there. It's a target. They attack it and set it on fire. But they would have you believe if the federal agents leave, everything would be good. Look, in war, you have to make decisions. And sometimes you look back and say, why do we ever get into that? And I'm not just talking about getting into the full war, but particular battles. How many times in Vietnam? And it had happened in World War II and Korea, and I'm sure others since then. Did we claim that this hill, this is crucial, we need this hill. We fight to take the hill. We take the hill at great casualties and losses. And 2 days later, we don't even care about the damn hill. We're on to something else. So that's what I guess we're going to look at on this courthouse. We're going to go ahead and pull back, see if the Oregon State Police will hold the line and to see what will happen when they get attacked. Now, if you think these rioters will go back to being just protesters and not throwing things and attacking, then why they've been doing it elsewhere at other facilities that are not federal? We're going to spend more time on that in the next hour. But again, this hearing yesterday between Attorney General Barr, I say between, he was brought in to be a witness. And yet, what you had from the very beginning, nitpicking, stabbing, cutting, slandering, slurring A.G. Barr from the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee. Barr couldn't even answer some of the questions. They wouldn't allow him the time. Here's an exchange that took place when Congressman Jordan, who is the Republican serving on the committee, called out Nadler, saying, you're not allowing Barr to even answer a question. Just listen.
For months you've tried to get the Attorney General to come. He's here. Why don't you let him speak? Why don't you let him answer the questions?
Gentleman is not ready.
Time after time. If you want the Attorney General to come, at least let him answer the questions and the accusations made against him.
The gentleman's rudeness is not recognized.
Rudeness?
Rudeness is on the other side.
Mr. Stanton, this
time after hearing. Time, you refuse to let the Attorney General of the United States answer the questions posed to him.
Time after time. And Jordan was being accused of being rude. He said, look, give Barr a chance to answer the question. Every time he tried to start to answer something, they would interrupt him. One Democrat on the panel had a piece of video or something flashed on a screen that Barr didn't get a chance to see it. And she said, that's one of your laws and that you operate by. Explain that. And he said, well, what was the law? She said, I just showed it to you. Well, he didn't see it. And he's kind of laughed like, how can I respond? And you know that incensed her. Some of the other members watching Nadler and the way he was handling this thing, you could hear them off camera laughing and even saying, this is unbelievable. Nadler could not keep control of the increasingly heated questioning. Part of his issue was, too, by the way, the mask. He was there with a mask, but he couldn't decide if he was going to keep it on. I mean, the mask itself became a funny little bit. Let me share with you what happened on that. So here's Nadler up there. telling all members, in fact, he called out several GOP members by name in the beginning because they didn't have their mask. He called out Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, Andy Biggs of Arizona, Mike Johnson of Louisiana, saying you're removing your mask, you're violating the safety of the members of this committee. Now, one of them said, is it not permissible to drink coffee? Nadler quickly said, it's not permissible. But that might have stemmed from confusion as to Nadler was confused as to who had just spoken, who was next. Jordan had to step in and remind him. And the big problem for Nadler is, for all of his preaching, his own mask was not covering his face, hanging halfway around his neck while he's making his point about endangering others during the COVID-19 pandemic. And in fact, there'd been video recently, just days ago, here's Jerry Nadler walking the streets of D.C., walking the streets, not wearing a mask. And yet in this event, he wants to make the mask the crucial event, along with trying to do their best to crucify A.G. Barr. And yes, I will tell you, and it was going to be in news and commentary coming up anyway, Congressman Louis Gohmert, who was not present at that event yesterday, but was scheduled to be on Air Force One with President Trump today on a flight to Texas. The Texas congressman has come down and been tested positive with COVID, so he will not be on that flight with the president. And Gohmert has been one of those who's anti-mask. Again, I've told you, it's up to you to make your decision. If a business says you can't come in unless you have it, then don't go to the business. But this whole hearing yesterday, Tim Scott, U.S. Senator from South Carolina, looking at how Barr was trying to respond and what was going on, he said A.G. Barr was undeniably powerful. They were afraid of his questions. Frankly, the Democrats were filibustering the answers to their own questions. He said that was obvious. It was amazing to watch. He said they would not allow Barr to answer, so that, as he pointed out, they were filibustering. When they'd ask a question, they'd start cutting in and filibustering and coming up with their own answer and not allowing him to answer. Senator Scott said the hearing was, quote, embarrassing for Democrats. He said, talking to folks who were watching the hearing, Republicans who paid close attention, Barr's answers were actually very clear, concise, direct. He was not going to be bullied, and that was also a powerful statement. And Senator Kennedy, John Kennedy of Louisiana, he said, I tried to watch it. I tried.
I finally turned it off because it was triggering my gag reflex. It wasn't a hearing. It was an attempted persecution. I think the American people saw that. The point that some of my Democratic colleagues seemed to be trying to make was that the Attorney General was out of control. But what they really mean is that he's out of their control.
That's probably a key point. He's not under their control. And Senator Kennedy of Louisiana said, I just couldn't watch anymore. It's triggering my gag reflex. You ever had that happen? You start watching something, you know, and you think, I can't watch or do any more of this. I'm going to get really sick. The senator pointed out that Barr was standing steady on his remarks and all the insults hurled by the Democrats, stating again he's guided by the rule of law. He doesn't do anyone's bidding. He calls it like he sees it. He said, I thought he was his usual unflappable self. And he's tough. He said, you got to be tough in that job. He's tough as a pine nut. Now respect that about him. Barr was brought up there. The Democrats were looking to make it a very big deal for them. They were getting the Attorney General in front of them with the House Judiciary Committee. And they were looking at breaking him. They were clearly looking at breaking him. They were clearly in their mind. I know that the night before I could just see them gathering. This is going to be good tomorrow. Oh, boy. Oh, sharpen the knives. There's going to be a bloodletting. We're going to gut that man right there on the floor. We'll watch it. We're going to get him. It didn't turn out like they thought. It didn't turn out at all. And it wasn't just the questions and how they filibustered their own questions so he couldn't answer, but how they treated him in general. Here's another example. This whole event got delayed yesterday about an hour because Jerry Nadler, the House Judiciary Chairman, was involved in a little car wreck before he got there. He was not hurt, but it delayed everything for an hour. Now, that's understandable. I'm glad Nadler was not hurt. I'm glad he was able to show up. So they went ahead and did it, but it got delayed because of that little car accident. He couldn't help it. He got delayed. So that's all acceptable. Well, now they've been going on these questionings for some time after waiting already an hour for him to get there, which, again, is understandable. And the attorney general really needs a break. He reached a point where I need a break. Just listen.
Mr. Chairman, could we take a five-minute break?
Ms. Dean is recognized.
Could we take a five-minute break, Mr. Chairman?
No.
That's a common courtesy, Ms. Dean is Chairman, of every witness.
I waited 45, an hour for you this morning. I haven't had lunch. I'd like to take a five-minute break.
Mr. Attorney General, we are almost finished. We're going to be finished in a few minutes. We can certainly take a break. But
you're real classy. Well,
okay. Yeah. After this, if you still want one, we'll have a break.
No, he wants a break now.
You want it now?
And you just mentioned rudeness. I think we're seeing it on display. Let's let the Attorney General have a break.
Committee will stand and recess it now.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Finally, he did. That was classy. Took the break. They came back, and they were done within 15 minutes after that. Hey, is Biden ready to select a running mate? Wait to hear this latest news coming up.
You can connect with Larry on Twitter at Larry Connors USA.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
Democrat Senator Kamala Harris, of course, wanted to be president. Remember, she was one of the candidates before dropping out in 2019. She has since endorsed and campaigned for Biden since March. She wants that second spot. There's no doubt about it. Well, a photographer caught a list of Biden's handwritten notes, and on it you can read a section titled Kamala Harris, followed by remarks like, "Do not hold grudges. Campaign with me and Jill. Talented. Great respect for her." Well, that says maybe she's first up in the sights. And there was a piece that came out the other day from The Beacon saying, "Is Kamala Harris planting evidence on her VP rivals?" There's no doubt Biden's going to choose a woman, probably a woman of color. Kamala Harris would be at the top, except there are a couple others that had to be considered. Former Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, I say current mayor, I did mean former, and also Congresswoman Demings of Florida, Congresswoman Bass, Democrat of California, obviously. Any woman, and particularly one of color. Bottoms, though, has been tied as a controversial figure to Kasim Reed, that being the controversial figure, former Atlanta mayor, who left office in disgrace. ABC News did a story on that. The Washington Free Beacon did a piece on Kamala Harris, of course, previously on some of her failings. But most of the articles coming out now going after Bottoms and anyone, Demings, for instance, being another, that might be on Biden's list. The question being raised is Kamala Harris putting these stories out, trying to destroy the other women as possible candidates. And the one that could still be at the top of the list, according to Politico, Susan Rice. Susan Rice, who had served, of course, as former National Security Advisor under Obama, had a close relationship with Joe Biden, that Susan Rice might be going to the very top of it. Valerie Jarrett, who served as a senior advisor to Obama, said Biden has seen her not just in good times, but in really hard and challenging occasions. And they say Rice could be moving right up to the top. That's enough to worry, of course, Kamala Harris, because she's trying to destroy others, but this case for Susan Rice might be growing. you might see more stuff begin to come out about Susan Rice. And if so, is it being fed by Kamala Harris? If this piece written by the Free Beacon the other day is accurate, that Kamala Harris might be planning, it's a question, really. Is Kamala Harris planning evidence on her VP rivals? Well, she's got to look at, what do I do about Susan Rice? The Atlantic even described Harris as, quote, shadow campaign for vice president, saying it's a very open secret. And the New York Times reported that she had, quote, been maneuvering privately to avoid coming across as pathetically desperate. I like that. But there'd even been a story at one time, by the way, that came out in Politico, as a matter of fact, saying that Joe Biden has chosen Kamala Harris to be his running mate. Politico wrote that story. Where did they get it? I don't know, but they had to really remove it because it turned out it was wrong, obviously. AP released the same story that Biden had chosen Kamala Harris. They also had to retract it. No one is saying where the story originated. Kamala Harris, are you on the phone? Hello, hello. Are you calling these folks saying you're going to be the person? Hey, we'll take a break. When we come back, the plot to change America. You don't want to miss it.
You can hear podcasts of this program at Larry Connors USA Facebook. Larry Connors USA Facebook.
Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a ever-loving light on me. Yonder come his roses.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
My next guest we've had on numerous times before, Mike Gonzalez. He's with the Heritage Foundation. Mike was born in Cuba, left at age 12 in 72. He's been all over as a reporter and then joining Heritage, but he's also done additional speech writing for folks like President George W. Bush and others, and then also published repeatedly in numerous major publications, every major publication you can think, and every major network he's been on. And now out with a book titled The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Mike, glad to have you back on board again.
Larry, as always, it's a real pleasure to be on with
you. Well, I got to tell you, the timing for this book is right on target because that's exactly what we're going through right now, the identity politics, and wrap that up with political correction or whatever else you want to say, and we're at each other all over. You take the floor for a few moments.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad you have me on. My book, The Plot to Change America, could not be more timely, and I say that with a heavy heart because the state that the country's in, basically, it tries to expose what identity politics is, and that is very briefly the division of the country into groups that are based on race or ethnicity or sex or sexual orientation or gender or even disability status, and overlays that with a victimhood culture that says that you all have a certain degree of grievances and victimhood value, and this is claim to attention and you claim to compensatory justice, and it divides the country between the oppressor group and the other subordinate and oppressed groups. And the problem with that, Larry, as you can see, is that not only divides society and makes us hate each other, but it never ends, because if you derive your sense of dignity and your rewards from being a victim, you don't want to stop being a victim. You have zero incentive to overcome your problems.
And in cases if you don't agree, extortion is put on you that you either succumb and agree and roll over, or you are shamed into being called something that you're not. I mean, the hardest thing for someone to defend is someone calls you a racist. I'm not a racist, but immediately you got to start looking for defenses. And you talk about, here's something I want to get into. You point out, and you're exposing in this book, that identity politics, and that's part of it, is supposedly a grassroots movement, but you don't see it that way.
No, not in the least. It really is an elite project. When these groups were erected back in the 1960s and 70s, the people who were being hemmed, herded into categories did not like them. you know, UCLA sent out many surveyors to the Southwest to survey Mexican Americans, and they came back, and the Mexican Americans actually did not feel like victims. They did not feel like they were members of a minority. They knew that they faced discrimination, but they thought that they could resolve these problems individually through their own individual agency and action. And this horrified people, because what they wanted to do was create collectivized groups. So the hard work of instilling grievances into people began. Herbert Marcuse, who is one of the gurus of this whole project, I talk about him a lot in my book, The Plot to Change America, said, had this famous phrase that that liberation depends on the consciousness of servitude. So you have to tell people you have a state of servitude. You have grievances. You must overthrow the American system, change it fundamentally, and that is the problems that we see today.
Well, the other part of that is, since you brought up the Mexicans and the census look and so forth, part of that is a demographic change in the country that says we are changing anyway, and we've got to be more accepting. Well, we do obviously have changes going on. We understand that. And, in fact, I know you've seen the same projections I have, that in the not-too-distant future, the majority race-ethnic break in this nation will be probably Latino, Mexican, or some mix of that, and black Americans will be third on the list at that point.
Well, what I say in my book is that this is part of the project. This is not taken into account of something that demographers know as ethnic attrition. First of all, America has always been changing demographically. America has always been multi-ethnic. America changed incredibly demographically in the 1850s and even prior to that, and then much more so with Ellis Island, when Italians and Jews from Eastern Europe and Slavs began to come in. What we had never been is multicultural, and that's the new thing. Now, what the purveyors of identity politics tried to do is they tried to get rid of ethnic attrition. That is, somebody who is a quarter Korean, a quarter Polish, a quarter Mexican, and a quarter German is an American. It used to be called a Heinz 57 American. What these activists say is like, No, you will be whatever, one of the groups that are supposed to be considered suppressed, and you will have grievances that go along with this.
So you have to be a victim. You've got to be a victim.
Right. You have to be a victim. Yes.
And therefore, that gives them a chance to lead you to a better hallowed ground, and we can step on other people in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it is a problem because it puts grievances on a hamster wheel. This is not the model that you want to have if you're building society. If you're building society, you want to have a striving for solving problems. We have problems in America. We have racists in America. Tell you what, Larry, I have lived, as you said, in 7 or 8 different countries in the world at least a year. There are racists in every country in the world. We're actually one of the least racist countries in the world. America, the American story is one of great prosperity and liberty. That's why we have attracted immigrants. That's why we're multi-ethnic. We have attracted 1 million immigrants from 1850 to the present. That attraction continues today. The line is very long at the door for people waiting to get in. There's no line of people waiting to get out. That alone should tell you that this experiment in freedom and prosperity should not be changed. It should be improved at the margins, of course.
But
there's no reason.
But your point, there are not long lines of those waiting to get out, but there are long lines and gathering and massing protests and so forth inside that want to change this country from the inside out.
Oh, absolutely. But they want to change America. I mean, this is, by the way, this is a minority of people. They've been taught at universities and from the very beginning to hate America. This is not what we want to do with our children, by the way. We really should start rethinking, why are we doing this? Why do we allow our children to be indoctrinated into thinking that the founding was a ruse, a conspiracy by rich men to retain their privilege? Why do we want people to hate George Washington and Jefferson? I was I was listening to a reporter from PBS 2 weeks ago describing Jefferson as a slave owner and a rapist. You know, Jefferson wrote a Declaration of Independence, our founding document. We all have nobody is perfect. None of them were perfect. Lincoln wasn't perfect. Martin Luther King wasn't perfect. But we honor King and Lincoln in Washington because they all believed in America. Martin Luther King believed in America, deeply so, believed in the promise of America. We have heroes for a reason.
You're listening to Mike Gonzalez, author of the new book, The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. And this identity politics and that division, they want to widen that division, Mike. They have no desire to unify unless it's all on their side of the fence.
That's right. And the reason why I called it a plot, there are obviously, Larry, no Thursday night meetings in the basement, but everybody is reading from the same text. All the top people, all the main people are influenced by something called critical race, critical theory, which is something, you know, originated in Frankfurt, in the Frankfurt School. It's about how you must criticize all aspects of America, criticize its norms, criticize its traditions, change it completely. By the way, they never criticized the Soviet Union. Critical theory, people who looked into critical theory emerged and began. It was really aimed at the West and really aimed at America. It was about changing the American story and introducing a hegemonic narrative. This is something that once you expose it, and that's what I try to do in my book, The Plot to Change America, once you expose it to Americans, this is where we get these groups. This is why it was done. This is how it was done. I think people, what I try to do is change the terms to how people think about this. We have all heard the term identity politics, but we don't really have a description of it. I supply one, and I tell you why it happened.
Well, in 30 seconds, I mean, do you see us reunifying in the near future, or are things getting worse?
Well, I got good news and bad news. The bad news is, you know, Adams said the revolution really happened the way people thought, the colonists thought in 50 years prior to 1776. I do wonder if we're beginning to change how we think. However, the Marxists fail always because they try to do something. It's a supremely vain project. They think they can change human nature. Because they cannot, they always fall upon coercion and violence.
All right.
I don't think that's going to work here. We have cancel culture. We have many problems, but I don't think you can coerce Americans. Americans love and embrace freedom. I think
you're right about that. Mike, I want to thank you again. Congratulations on the book, The Plot to Change America. It's available now by Mike Gonzalez, and it's right on target at this point. Mike, again, we appreciate it. We'll have you back in the future again, sir.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Larry. Thank you very much.
You bet. Mike Gonzalez. Some of what he was talking about also brings up the 60s revolution in my mind. I want to share that with you when we continue.
Baby, I got your number. All I know that you got mine. I called too many times. You can call me, baby. You can call me anytime. You got to call me.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
Larry Connors, USA.
You know, Mike Gonzalez's book, The Plot to Change America, there's so many plots that have been underway for decades to change America in different ways. Now, the 60s, of course, we had a revolution in many ways. We saw demonstrations become violent, the Watts riots of 65, protests of the 68 Democrat National Convention in Chicago, and, of course, the Vietnam War and college deferments, all of that turned peaceful civil disobedience into greater protests. And you had terrorists like the Weathermen come in that start bombing dozens of government buildings. I'm looking at a piece that was written by Victor Davis Hanson for the National Review and pointing out, quote, today's revolutionaries aren't like their 60s predecessors. And he goes over the same things I was just discussing with you. but he's pointing out that the revolution at that time was introducing the nation to everything from hippies, communes, free love, mass tattooing, commonplace profanity, rampant drug use, rock music, high divorce rates, to the war on poverty, feminism, affirmative action, race, gender, ethnic, college curriculum. And at that time, the fight was against the establishment, politicians, corporations, military, and square parents, because the parents didn't seem to know what they were doing, according to the law of the young at that point. And he points out in his piece, Victor Davis Hanson, that since the 60s, today's revolution is vastly different and far more dangerous. He says, in fact, that America is far less resilient now and a far more divided, indebted, vulnerable target than in the 60s. Because right now, radicals are not protesting against the conservatism of the 50s, but rather against radicals of the 60s, whose old liberals now hold power. Many of the current enforcers, blue state governors, mayors, police chiefs, and pointing out that the 60s protests were racial assimilation and integration. That was Martin Luther King's agenda, making race incidental, not essential. But he points out in this article, that's not true with today's cultural revolution. It wants to ensure that racial difference is a foundation of American life, dividing the country between supposed non-white victims and purported white victimizers, past and present. Again, that's right on target with Gonzalez's book, Plot to Divide America. The piece in National Review by Hanson is right on target of what we're dealing with right now. He said today's divide, he believes, is also geographic in the fashion of 1861, not just generational, it's in the 60s. The two blue coasts seem to despise the vast red interior, and vice versa. He points out corporations are no longer seen as evil, but as woke contributors to the revolution. I would add to that, they're woke contributors only when they get extorted. I mean, and you look at what's happening with sports teams and all the other companies that suddenly decide to put Black Lives Matter or anything else. They think if we do this, we're gaining points. And if we don't do it, then we'll be called out for it. So the better thing is do it. In other words, you're extorted into putting something up and posting it otherwise. The Dallas Cowboys and the National Football League, remember when we had the officers who were protecting a Black Lives Matter protest in Dallas? And they got ambushed and six of them killed. Do you remember the Dallas Cowboys wanted to wear on their helmets for the following game decals honoring the Dallas police officers killed? And the NFL said, no, no such political statements. Now look how far we've come. I previously pointed out to you that Trader Joe's under attack because a California high school senior claimed that Trader Joe's branding was racist, and he started a petition and got more than 4,800 signatures. And Trader Joe's is indicating, okay, we understand. I mean, we do have things like we call our packaging that sometimes we thought was just kind of building upon our names, like, you know, Trader Jose's Tacos or Trader Gito's pasta or Trader Mean's Chinese food. They said we were just kind of building upon it. It's kind of our trade brand. That's all we were doing. We were not trying to be racist. Well, the petition got thrown in their face, and immediately Trader Joe's decided, okay, I guess we're woke now too, so we'll start taking that all off. We'll take all of those off. We won't have Trader Jose Tacos anymore because it's racist. Well, that was never their intent, any more than the Washington Redskins was intended to be offensive. It was meant to lift up great warriors. You don't want to call your team an offensive name and make it look like it's not capable of dealing with the other. Here we are with a corporation attack, as we were saying a moment ago. So Trader Joe's was one of those that suddenly also had to buckle. Well, now they apparently are deciding, you know what, we're not going to go that way. They have now decided that they're not going to replace some of those products that resonate with their customers. They say Trader Gito's, Trader Jose's, Trader Mean's. We're going to keep the terms. Our shoppers like them. They were not intended to be racist. They're not now, and we're going to keep them. Good for Trader Joe's. You got to start standing up to this and fight back on it. You cannot constantly roll over but too many do because they fear extortion, pressures, and everything else. Next hour, the latest on Portland. Federal agents apparently going to be pulled out. Oregon State Police supposedly will go in. We'll see how that plays out. Coming up in the next hour.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
You've been listening to Larry Connors USA. Please listen to previous and future podcasts.